I remember when I was young and at school, I once went to the games pitch. It didn't happen regularly, but it did happen on this particular occasion, and I went with a chap called Tipman. Now, I didn't know him at all, and we walked down the path towards the game pitch together and just got talking to him about what I believed and why I believed it. And when we got to the games pitch, he turned around to me and he said, Bob, I'd like a Bible to look at. And I can't explain to you how that made my heart jump with joy. I'm not saying he became a Christian, but he wanted to find out more. And wow, that was an amazing, amazing feeling. Sharing our faith. Spurgeon, the great Baptist preacher, said this: even if I was the most self-centered and selfish man on the planet, I would still choose to be a soul winner for Christ. Because actually, nothing feels quite like the joy that comes from having a hand in helping someone on their journey to find Jesus. It's something that I suppose we all feel that we should be doing and we'd love to be able to do. But the question is, how? How do we do that? Well, that's what we're going to have a look at together this morning. I'd like to tell you a quick story about the master craftsman, the boat, and the bill. It was in the earlier days of when they had these super ocean liners. And there was a boat that had just been launched. It was a new boat, and there were thousands of people who'd paid lots of money to be on this luxury ocean liner. And the day came for it to start. And the captain gave the signal. The champagne bottle was ready. He turned the key or whatever they do to start it, and it didn't go. There was kind of a loud clicking noise, and that was it. And he had this huge multi-million pound boat full of excited passengers, and it broken down, and you really can't call the AA out to things like that. And there was a panic, and they went down to the engine room and said, what's the matter? And they said, well, we don't know what the matter is. So, well, what can we do? And they said, but we're not absolutely sure. Whatever's happened here is not a usual thing on our checklist of what we can switch and turn and adjust to get things to go. What are we going to do? And this old bloke who was in the engine room said, I know what you'd be needing to do. And they looked at him and said, well, what's that? He said, you need to get old Jacob down here. I said, well, who's that? He said, well, Jacob used to work on these boats and used to oversee the putting together of the engines. He said, and if anyone knows how to fix this, old Jake, you'll know. Now, he'd been retired for about 20 years, so he really was a very old man, this guy. And they sent someone out in a car to his house and said, please could you come right now? He said, yeah, I'll be coming then. And he picked up his small bag of tools, got in the car, and they took him to the ocean liner. They took him down to the engine room. He said, then what would be the problem? And they explained that this. He said, all right, then, he said. He took his bag, and he went and crawled down in amongst the engine and all the complicated things, and he took out a hammer. And then the owners of the ocean liner, watching from the platform, heard a loud bang. And old Jake came up and said, well, you'd be needing to start her up again now then. They started her up. And off she went. He said, well, I'll be seeing you then. He said, and I'll send my bill through in due time. Anyhow, 3 weeks later, his bill comes through. It's for £5,000 and 28p. So it goes through to the accounts department, and they write to him and say, "Dear Mr. Jacob, we're confused by your bill. We wonder if you could give us a breakdown of how you got to this figure." And he wrote back, said, "Surely," he said, "that would be 28p for the actual hit of the hammer and £5,000 for knowing where to hit it." The master craftsman. Well, this morning, we're simply going to look at Jesus. That's all we're going to do. And watch, if you like, the master fisherman go to work. But doing it in seemingly very ordinary way. And that's, my friends, how we need to be. We need to be ordinary people with an extraordinary God. So how do we share our faith? How do we do it? Let's have a look at this encounter that Jesus has with this Samaritan woman at the well, and let's see what we can learn from him. John chapter 4, you might like to turn to it. John chapter 4, verses 1 to 6. The Pharisees heard that Jesus was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John, although in fact it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. When the Lord learned of this, he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. Now he had to go through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well, for it was about the sixth hour. Let's just stop there. Jesus was baptizing and gaining more disciples than John. Verse 1. You see, the one to whom John the Baptist had pointed, well, he'd come. So people started flocking to the one who had the words of life. Because the truth is, Jesus was the word of life himself. But of course, when something like that happens, the religious authorities start to notice. And now was not the time in Jesus' ministry where he wanted to have that clash. So he decided to pull back and to return to Galilee. Now, if you're going to go that journey, the place to go is through Samaria. It's shorter and it's quicker. So that's the way that people would go. So it says that, well, verse 4, Jesus had to go through Samaria to get to where he was going. And that's really the first point that I'd like to bring to your attention this morning. For Jesus, his mission field, if you like, it was around him, wherever he happened to be, in the normal course of events in his day. I mean, this encounter with the woman happened while he was stopping for a drink because he was tired and thirsty. Isn't it wonderful to know that we have a God who understands our needs? It happened there. He stopped for a drink. And a simple thing like that became an evangelistic opportunity. Like perhaps walking down the road in Bristol, doing the shopping, being at work, on the phone. You see, what I believe that we need to learn how to do as a church, as Christians, is we need to learn how to be naturally evangelistic. Naturally evangelistic. And that starts with us looking at where God's put us in the normal course of our daily lives and seeing the opportunities that there are there. Because each of us has been placed in a unique mission field. There are people who you know and who you can reach that I haven't got a hope of doing that. Because I'm not in those places. I'm not in that mission field. And we need to release ourselves from the pressure and strain of thinking, oh, I've got to get out there. and convert somebody. We need to get rid of that pressure that's often put on us, because that to me implies I've got to go somewhere and do something that's completely alien to me. We don't all need to go and bang a drum with a megaphone outside Sainsbury's supermarket. In fact, I'm not sure anyone needs to do that, but don't quote me on that. What we need to do is to have a look around us and make the most of the opportunities that actually we already have. And we might be overlooking because they're too ordinary. So in the normal, everyday course of events, Jesus goes to get a drink. And as he does so, he gets into conversation with this woman. Verse 7. A Samaritan woman came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" Because Jews do not associate with Samaritans. That's my second point, really. Jesus had a perfectly normal kind of conversation with her, and he asked her for something. He asked her for something. See, he didn't start by introducing himself to her as God. "Oh, good afternoon, yeah, I'm God." He could have done, but he didn't do that. He didn't come across as being superior. He was, but he didn't say that. He took things at her pace and gently brought her on to the place where she needed to be. You know, we're told that it was midday, and that means the sun was at its hottest. Now, having lived in Africa, let me tell you that nobody goes and gets water at 12 o'clock in those climates. And women certainly don't go and do it by themselves. The women in the African villages, they would go at the beginning of the day and the end of the day, and they'd go together because they wanted to chat. So the reason why she is there in the midday sun all by herself must be something to do with relationships and lifestyle and what other people thought or said about her in that village. And yet Jesus didn't make her feel small. In fact, perhaps in a funny sort of way, he paid her a compliment by asking her to do something for him. But it took her by surprise. You see, these two groups, the Jews and the Samaritans, well, they had some history, if I can put it like that. You remember the Old Testament? You've got King Saul, and then King David, and then King Solomon, and then the country splits into two parts: a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom, and they each have their own kings, separate from each other. Well, the Bible tells us in Kings that there was a king called Omri, who was in the northern kingdom. And it's through him that you get that name Samaria. If you're a note taker, that can be found in 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 24. But the problem is that they got overtaken by the Assyrians, this northern kingdom. And what the Assyrians did is they got the brains and the pick of the crop and the best people from the northern kingdom and carted them off into exile. Then they repopulated it with the pagans, together with their religion, from round about. So later on, when the people came back out of exile, they looked at this bunch of people as being rebels and kind of racial cocktail and all these kind of things. They weren't good, pure people, these Samaritans, to associate yourself with. And actually, the Samaritans ended up kind of building their own temple on a different mountain, Mount Gerizim, in about, 400 BC. They had their own temple. But then, a couple of hundred years after that, a king from the southern went and knocked it down. So you've got this kind of two temples and two hills and stuff. And that's, of course, what happens later on in this story when she's talking about which mountain do we worship God on. That's all to do with this kind of history of the Samaritans and the people from the southern kingdom. Actually, they developed their own theology. The Samaritans had what they call the Samaritan Pentateuch, which means five books. So the Samaritans believed in just the first five books of the Bible and not the rest. So they had dodgy theology too. So there was just a whole load of reasons, historical and racial and just all this kind of stuff that you know people have. They had that. Also, you wouldn't talk to a woman if you were a guy by yourself. That's not done either. So you've got lots of kind of no-nos there. Lots of social and religious and political boundaries being crossed in this simple question from Jesus. Can you do something for me? Can I have a drink? I do wonder in my wanderer, if when it says in verse 4 Jesus had to go through Samaria, if actually there was something else behind that and Jesus needed to, because he wanted to tell these people, I came to save you too. So that's why this woman is surprised by Jesus asking her for something in that scene round the well. And I suppose that we too need to be sensitive to the Holy Spirit's guiding in our own lives and be prepared to speak to whoever God brings our way, even if they're not our kind of people. So she says, how can you ask me for a drink? But that's not cutting the conversation off, is it? That's actually, in a way, giving Jesus permission to take the conversation a bit further. I remember mentioning a couple of weeks ago that I went to this keyboard shop looking for keyboards. You know, I wasn't looking for converts, I was looking for keyboards. And so we went to a keyboard shop, and this bloke started talking about this new keyboard with its supernatural voices. And remember I said to him, we have supernatural voices in our church on Sundays. And he said, shut up. No, he didn't say shut up, you see. He said, don't preach at me. No, he didn't say that. He said, I could do with some of that in my life. It may make my life easier. So that was him giving me permission to take the conversation further in the same way that she did in this situation. Let's press on a bit. Verse 10. Jesus said to her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. So the woman said, you've got nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself? Answer? Yes, I made the well, and I made Jacob, and I made you, and I made the world. He doesn't chip that in at this point, but I just say to you that is in fact the answer to that question. I want to tell you what no one ever told me for a very long while. And I never heard it in a sermon. And I never read it in a book. Thinking about this question, how can I share my faith? Nobody told me this for many, many years. But it's probably one of the most important things if you want to share your faith. How many people I've heard say to me over the years, I love the Lord and I want to talk to people about Jesus, but the opportunity never seems to arise. And I don't know when it would be appropriate to say something. I think that's where the rub is, isn't it? I don't know how to bring the things of God into a conversation in a natural and unforced way. In a way that shows, in a way that is good news. Well, let's look at the context here. They're by a well, they're thirsty, there is water in the well, and that water has to be regularly drawn out to satisfy this need. Therefore, the starting point for the conversation is water. Water. That's what Jesus talks about. And we believe that the gospel is good news for everybody in their situation. The woman has a need, and Jesus starts by showing her how God can meet that need in a way that is perhaps far deeper than she's ever thought about before. But it's still linked to that water. And then, of course, he starts to talk about the deeper issues with her. He starts by throwing out some bait. That's what I wasn't taught. That's what nobody told me. What I need to do is just casually throw out spiritual bait. You know, Jesus calls us to be fishers of men. And you don't catch fish by getting your rod and bashing it on the water so all the fish run away. No. You gently and appropriately throw out some spiritual bait. That's what I wasn't told. That's what Jesus did here. Water, thirst. Living water's available, you know. She's not going to say to him, stop preaching at me. Because what he's saying is good news. It sounds better than what she's got. So she's not going to say you're Bible thumping because she's interested. I remember once we were in Dagenham, which was sort of like the armpit of London. And I just like to just walk around and see what's happening. And I walked on this huge council estate. In our church patch, there were 27,000. And most of it was council estates. And I walked down through it, and then I saw this garden that was immaculate. And I'm rubbish in the garden. And there was this little old bloke in it doing stuff with it. And I thought, I'm just going to go and see what that's all about. I said, hello, I said. My name's Bob, and I'm the minister of the little church down the road here. Just thought I'd come round. I said, you know, people say that the church never comes to us. I said, so here I am. And his response was, ooh, I'm not interested in church. I thought to myself, that went down well, didn't it? I said, okay then, well, I'll be on my way. I said, I just wanted to ask you something before I go. I said, what's that? I said, all this stuff in your garden, I mean, how do you get your garden to look like this? I mean, mine's in total ruins, and you've got all these plants, and they all seem to match. I said, I mean, what is this? What's that plant? Oh, he said, well, that's a blue one of those, and that's that. And I said, and how do you get them to grow like this? He said, well, 10 minutes later, he said, would you like to come in and have a cup of tea? So I went in and had tea. I thought, right, I'm in. I'm over the doorstep. I'm in the living room. Praise the Lord, salvation has come to this house today. And he says, Peggy, would you bring in some tea, please, for the vicar? I heard this thumping and stuff in the kitchen. In comes Peggy with this tray. And I promise you, she puts it down the table. She looks at me and says, I don't like anyone telling me when I'm going to go to church. I want to go to church when I want to go to church. And walked out. That's all she said to me. That was it. So I had the cup of tea and was talking about gardens. I thought, what am I going to do now? And then this new idea came in mind, evangelism by employment. So I said, Morris, do you ever do anyone else's gardens for them? He said, well, I have done in the past. I said, I could really do with a hand. You wouldn't mind, you know, maybe just given a couple of hours, it was about September, a couple of hours a week in the garden. I said, I'll give you £7 or something for doing it. He said, yeah, he said, I'll come round. So he started to come round. And Jane had all these posters on the wall, you know, like fluffy ducks, Jesus is like a hen, and, you know, all this kind of Christian drippy stuff. It was all over the kitchen covers. And it was a terraced house, so we had to go through the kitchen to the back garden. So we had to read all this stuff as he went through. Anyway, he came, we got on all right and stuff. And then it got to be November time, where the garden closes down. And he said to me, he said, Bob, I think next week will be the last time I need to come, because there's not really anything for me to do. I said, well, I've really enjoyed you coming, so I'll see you next week. So we prayed. I thought, I've got to say something. So when he finished the next, I said, Morris, I wondered if you and Peggy would like to come to my church on Sunday. He said, yes, he said, that would be lovely, and walked out. So anyway, Sunday comes, and the church was an ex-London City mission hut that had been bombed by a Zeppelin in the First World War. So we're talking high quality here at this church. And it was really cold. And so I was just about to start, so I thought, they've not come yet. And then suddenly they came, and Morris came, and then Peggy came with a big overcoat on. They sat at the two chairs nearest the door so they could get out. She didn't take her coat off, and when the end came, she just disappeared. I thought, well, that's that. Then next week, they came again. The next week, they came again. So I thought, that's interesting. And then I invited them round for tea, and they came for tea, and we had cream cakes and stuff and a cup of tea. And then there was a really dodgy, frosty bit, and Morris had fallen over on the Saturday and hurt his leg, so he couldn't come. And Peggy came by herself. And I thought, Lord, you're doing something there. What did it start with? It started with me talking about gardens that I know nothing about, asking him if he wouldn't mind helping me. And the Lord worked through that, you see. But it was only ordinary stuff. I think it's listening to people and noticing how people are living and what they're saying and stuff. And as you notice things, then you get ideas of things, bait that you might throw out that's appropriate and relevant. And if they don't say anything about that, if they ignore that, that's fine. It was never your job to convert them. Only God can do that. That's fine. Keep going. On to the next situation. On to the next person. It's not about us and how good we are at it. It's about God. When you go into the newspapers, the news agents, or the supermarkets, you go into the news agents and whatever daft thing the church has been up to is on page two of the, you know, and you open and say, oh, so church is at it again. And then the bloke in the newspaper says, yeah, so full of hypocrites, isn't it? I said, you know, it's funny you should say that, and away you go. It may be, you know, it's a friend who's facing difficulty. It may be a work colleague who's feeling lonely or depressed or something. I said, I know exactly how you feel. I said, I feel like that so often myself. That's why I'm so glad I can pray. But either they're going to ignore that, or they're going to say, what do you mean by that? Or does that really help? Bang! They're giving you permission to go on. Did you see? Fellow students facing pressures of exams. The big issue, so I'm walking down the road with Michael Green, who's got a brain the size of a planet, and has been doing evangelism longer than I've been alive by about at least twice. And I'm walking down the road with Michael Green. We're talking about evangelism. And all of a sudden, I look round, he's gone. I thought, oh no, the Lord's come back. He's taken him and left me. I thought, where is he? And he's on the floor with this big issue salesman saying, yeah, do you know what? He's got a really posh voice. Do you know what? Have you ever thought about the big issue and what that really is? What's the big issue really is? And he's, you know, he's talking big issue stuff with this guy. So Jesus has just thrown out some bait. There's living water available. Oh yes, there's living water available. Now, she doesn't fully understand what he's talking about, clearly, at this point, because she's talking about, well, you haven't got any kind of bucket to draw it up with or anything. She doesn't understand him. But there's something about what he's saying that feels like it might be good news to her in her situation. It's the possibility of something more than she has. Verse 15, the woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." Her response is, "Yes, I want to know more. Keep going. Keep talking." Jesus isn't forcing on her. He's not pushing his opinion on her. She is giving Jesus permission to take it further. And so he does. Of course, the truth is, at the end of the day, in order to receive the gift, she's got to receive the giver, hasn't she? And we're talking about Jesus and who he is. Now, Jesus doesn't not deal with the real deep issues. It's just he doesn't start there. He waits until it's right, until it's appropriate. Give me this water. I want this water. Jesus said, "Of course I will. Why don't you just pop off and bring your husband with you? Because he could find out too." He told her, "Go and call your husband and come back." "I have no husband," she replied. Jesus said to her, "You're right when you said you have no husband. The fact is, you've had 5 husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. So what you've said is quite true." "Sir," she said, "I can see that you're a prophet." He puts his finger, actually, on the real need in her life. And sometimes we do need to help people to come to terms with what the issue really is in their lives. But we need to do it in the right way, as it says in 1 Peter 3:15, with gentleness and respect. Jesus didn't say, "Yeah, well, that's because you're adulterous. That's why no one's here with you collecting water." He didn't put it like that. He just said, "Why don't you go and get your husband?" And like so many in our generation today, she has gone from person to person, looking for in other people significance, looking for love, for security, for fulfillment, for meaning, in person after person, after broken relationship, after broken relationship, after roommate, after roommate. But of course, the end of the day is that we can never look for in other people what can only be found in God. A real need. She was just looking in the wrong places. And so in verse 18, Jesus says something. In fact, you've had 5 husbands, and the man you're with is not your husband. He said something that he couldn't possibly have known, because he didn't know her and hadn't come from that village. I believe that was a supernatural word of knowledge from God, because he is God. It had been supernaturally revealed to him, and sometimes I believe God does that. We might not call it that, we might not think it's that, but we're talking with someone and something pops into our head and we just say it almost without thinking, and it just strikes straight to the heart. That's the Lord. And when we need that, he will do that. We just need to put it across sensitively. Could it be that, it might be that, how do you feel about, could put it like that, couldn't we? Rather than like that. He deals with the real issues in her life. And I think we need to realize that people come to faith in stages. You see, "Sir, I can see you're a prophet." She's gone from, this is just an ordinary bloke who seems to be speaking to me even though he's a Jew, to, "Sir, I can see that you're a prophet." She begins to have a kind of a revelation about who Jesus might be. She's not there yet, but she's on her way. And we need to let people take things at their pace and not push them. People come to faith in stages. Now she tries to change the subject. Did you get that? So the woman said, "I can see you're a prophet." And then she starts talking about where worship should take place. So she said to Jesus, if you're a God of love, why do you allow so much suffering in the world? She said, but actually you get a question like that, don't you? Now what I've learned is that a question like that needs to be taken seriously from the person who's asked it. So actually Jesus does take seriously her question about which mountain, north or south, should we worship God on? He answers her question, but he brings it back to the real answer, which is him. It's about her and it's about who he is. That's what the real question is and where the real answer is to be found. And sometimes people will say, you know, if God is a God of love, why does he allow suffering? And we've got to take those questions seriously, and I think we should do our best to answer them, but never set ourselves up as the encyclopedia who knows all the answers. There's nothing wrong with saying, I'm not sure, but I'll go and have a look and get back to you on that. I think also we need to spiritually try and search what's behind that question. I mean, from my experience, if someone asks a question like the suffering question, if we're talking evangelistically, it's A, because they genuinely want to know. It's B, because they just want a discussion. C, it might be because they want to change the subject, because it's getting too near to the knuckle. Or fourthly, it's because they're hurting themselves, or they know someone who's hurting and suffering. And I think we need to, with one ear, be kind of listening out. Now, I wonder why they're asking that. Because that actually helps you in how to give them a relevant answer to that. Why they're asking that. Perhaps we could say, why do you ask that? See what they say. But eventually, we need to bring the focus back to Jesus. Because he's the real deal. And he's the real answer. So it may be like that kid in school who I walked to the game pitch with and took him to the stage where he wanted to have a Bible and read it for himself. It may be the Lord wants to use you just for one stage in that person's journey of faith. That's wonderful. A joy to be part of that. It may be he wants you to seal the deal. Never be frightened to say to somebody if you think it's appropriate, I wonder, would you like to have Jesus in your life? But always leave the door open for the next time. You don't have to make someone become a Christian. Because actually, we don't make people become Christians. Only Jesus can change the human heart. Amri told us a story a few weeks back about the man who invited Billy Graham to drive the bus to get to the meeting, and then he actually ended up going in the meeting, then he ended up getting converted, then ended up converting half the world. How many people have come to faith through Billy Graham? And actually, in a smaller way, that happened through this woman, you know. Because if you were to read on, she said, Sir, I can see that you're a prophet. And then in verse 25, the woman said, I know the Messiah called Christ is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. And then we get chapter 4, verse 29. Come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Christ? And then in verse 42 we get, and they said to the woman, we no longer believe just because of what you've said. Now we've heard for ourselves and we know this man really is the saviour of the world. There's your coming to faith in stages progression, isn't it? How cool is that? From a conversation about water to the woman becoming a Christian, believing in Jesus, and spreading it around the village. That is church growth. And there's nothing pushed. Because for those people, if you get the way they said that, it was good news for them too. Even coming from her. So the starting point is simply this. We need to know what the good news is. And it has to be good news to us still. The second thing we need to know is that only God can change a human heart. We just need to be willing in some small, ordinary way, naturally evangelistic, to be part of that process in someone's life and maybe take a few small risks. So, my friends, in the mission field of your life, will you give it a go? Let's pray, shall we?